Oliver and to Tuvel. Some people commiserated, expressed support, and apologized for what was happening and for not going public with their support. As one academic wrote to me in a private message, "Sorry I'm not saying this publicly. I have no interest in battling the mean girls on Facebook. But for what it's worth, it's totally obvious to me that you haven't been committing acts of violence against marginalized scholars." Oliver noted that some scholars went beyond cowardice, privately supporting Tuvel while publicly attacking her. Quote, "In private messages, these people apologized for what she must be going through, while in public they fanned the flames of hatred and bile on social media. The question is, why did so many scholars, especially feminists, express one sentiment behind closed doors and another out in the open? Why were so many others afraid to say anything in public?" End quote. Durkheim and Bergesen give us a direct answer to Oliver's question. This is precisely what people do during a witch hunt. Retraction is the new rebuttal. Other open letters condemning professors and demanding retraction of their work soon followed. In August 2017, two law professors, Amy Wax from the University of Pennsylvania and Larry Alexander from the University of San Diego, wrote a short opinion essay in a Philadelphia newspaper titled "Paying the Price for Breakdown of the Country's Bourgeois Culture." They argued that many of today's social problems, including unemployment, crime, drug use, and the intergenerational transmission of poverty, are partially caused by the fading away of the bourgeois cultural script that used to compel Americans to get married before you have children and strive to stay married for their sake, get the education you need for gainful employment, work hard, and avoid idleness. The authors included one particular line that caused a firestorm. "All cultures are not equal, or at least they are not equal in preparing people to be productive in an advanced economy." The line is provocative because it violates a widespread taboo in the academic world. One is not supposed to say that a dominant culture is superior to a non-dominant one in any way. But anthropologists generally agree that cultures and subcultures instill different goals, skills, and virtues in their members. And it can't possibly be true that all cultures prepare children equally well for success in all other cultures. If we want to improve outcomes for immigrants and the poor in a free market, service-oriented, capitalist economy such as ours, Wax and Alexander argued, it would be useful to talk about bourgeois culture. A week later, 54 graduate students and alumni of the University of Pennsylvania published a statement that condemned the essay and its authors for exemplifying the malignant logic of heteropatriarchal, class-based white supremacy. In good Durkheimian fashion, the open letter issued a strong call for solidarity among all members of the University of Pennsylvania community who claim to fight systemic inequality, and it included a demand that the president of the university confront the racism of Wax and Alexander and push for an investigation into Wax's advocacy for white supremacy. The call for denunciation was taken up by 33 of Wax's colleagues in the law school, nearly half the faculty, who wrote their own open letter of denunciation. They did not do what scholars are supposed to do: use their scholarly abilities to show where Wax and Alexander were wrong. They simply condemned and categorically rejected Wax's claims. Solidarity or diversity? Solidarity is great for a group that needs to work in unison or march into battle. Solidarity engenders trust, teamwork, and mutual aid. But it can also foster groupthink, orthodoxy, and a paralyzing fear of challenging the collective. Solidarity can interfere with a group's efforts to find the truth, and the search for truth can interfere with a group's solidarity. The Greek historian Thucydides saw this principle in action over 2,000 years ago. Writing about a time of wars and revolutions in the 5th century BCE, he noted that the ability to understand a question from all sides meant that one was totally unfitted for action. This is why viewpoint diversity is so essential in any group of scholars. Each professor is, like all human beings, a flawed thinker with a strong preference for believing that his or her own ideas are right. Each scholar suffers from the confirmation bias, the tendency to search vigorously for evidence that confirms what one already believes. One of the most brilliant features of universities is that, when they are working properly, they are communities of scholars who cancel out one another's confirmation biases. Even if professors often cannot see the flaws in their own arguments, other professors and students do them the favor of finding such flaws. The community of scholars then judges which ideas survive the debate. We can call this process institutionalized disconfirmation. The institution, the academy as a whole, or a discipline such as political science, guarantees that every statement offered as a research finding, and certainly every peer-reviewed article, has survived a process of challenge and vetting. That is no guarantee that it is true, but it is a reason to think that the statement is likely to be more reliable than alternative statements made by partisan think tanks, corporate marketers, or your opinionated uncle. It is only because of institutionalized disconfirmation that universities and groups of scholars can claim some authority to be arbiters of factual questions, such as whether certain vaccines caused the rise in autism. They didn't. Or whether social programs designed to help poor children close achievement gaps with wealthier kids actually work. Some do, some don't. But what would happen to a university or an academic field if everyone were on the same team and everyone shared the same confirmation bias? The disconfirmation process would break down. Research shows that reviewers go easy on articles and grant proposals that support their political team, and they are more critical of articles and proposals that contradict their team's values or beliefs. This, to some extent, is what has happened in many academic fields since the 1990s, with enormous ramifications for university culture today. It's no surprise that on the whole, professors lean left. So do artists, poets, and people who love to watch foreign movies. One of the strongest personality correlates of left-wing politics is the trait of openness to experience, a trait that describes people who crave new ideas and experiences and who tend to be interested in changing traditional arrangements. On the other hand, members of the military, law enforcement personnel, and students who have well-organized dorm rooms tend to lean right. Seriously, you can guess people's political leanings at better-than-chance levels just from photographs of their desks. Social conservatives tend to be lower on openness to experience and higher on conscientiousness. They prefer things to be orderly and predictable, they are more likely to show up on time for meetings, and they are more likely to see the value of traditional arrangements. In a free society, therefore, it will simply never be the case that every occupation is evenly balanced politically, and it will generally be the case that professors lean left, especially in the humanities and social sciences. This is not a problem as long as there are enough professors who don't lean left to guarantee institutionalized disconfirmation in any field that addresses politicized topics. A left-to-right ratio of 2 or 3 to 1 should be enough to sustain institutionalized disconfirmation, and that's about what the ratio was for most of the 20th century. Figure 5.1, which you can find on our website, shows the percentage of professors across all fields who self-identified on a survey as being on the left, the right, or middle of the road. The left-to-right ratio in the early 1990s was around 2 to 1. The few studies we have that go back to the mid-20th century generally also show that professors leaned to the left or voted for Democrats, but not by a very lopsided margin. Things began to change rapidly, however, in the late 1990s. That's when the professors from the Greatest Generation began to retire, to be replaced by members of the Baby Boom generation. Beginning in the late 1990s, the percentage of left-leaning professors goes up, surpassing 60% by 2011. The percentage of right-leaning professors goes down to 12%. By 2011, therefore, the ratio had reached 5 to 1. the Greatest Generation professors were predominantly white men who had fought in World War II and then got a boost into higher education from legislation designed to help them in the post-war period. That wave of scholars included many Republicans and many conservatives. The baby boom professors, in contrast, were more diverse by race and gender, but less diverse in their politics. Many of them were influenced by the great wave of social protests in the 1960s. Many went into academic careers in the social sciences and education in order to continue to fight for social justice and progressive social causes. This is why the ratio changes so much more dramatically when we look at fields that are associated with addressing social justice concerns. In my field, academic psychology, the left-to-right ratio was between 2-to-1 and 4-to-1 from the 1930s through the mid-1990s. But then it began to shoot upward, reaching 17-to-1 by 2016. The ratios in other core fields in the humanities and social sciences are nearly all above 10-to-1. The imbalance is larger at more prestigious universities and in New England. The only field among all of the humanities and social sciences that is known to have enough political diversity to allow for institutionalized disconfirmation is economics, where the left-to-right ratio found in a study of the voter registrations of professors was a comparatively low 4-to-1. The loss of political diversity among professors, particularly in fields that deal with politicized content, can undermine the quality and rigor of scholarly research. Six social scientists, including me, wrote an academic article in 2015 that explains how. For example, when a field lacks political diversity, researchers tend to congregate around questions and research methods that generally confirm their shared narrative, while ignoring questions and methods that don't offer such support. The loss of political diversity among the faculty has negative consequences for students, too, in three ways. First, there's the problem that many college students have little or no exposure to professors from half of the political spectrum. Many students graduate with an inaccurate understanding of conservatives, politics, and much of the United States. 3 days after Donald Trump's wildly unexpected electoral victory, the editors of Harvard's main student newspaper made exactly this case in an editorial invoking Harvard's motto, Veritas, the Latin word for truth, calling on the administration to give them more political diversity. Quote, "The pursuit of Veritas, which undergirds our intellectual life, demands not only that each member of our community be able to debate politics freely, but also that we attend to the multitude of political views that exist in our nation. Stifling this discussion on campus is a disservice to our peers in the campus political minority and to our own educational growth." End quote. Second, the loss of viewpoint diversity among faculty means that what students learn about politically controversial topics will often be left-shifted from the truth. There is a range of reasonable opinions on many factual questions. For example, how much does raising the minimum wage cause employers to hire fewer low-skilled workers? How much of an influence do prenatal hormones have on the differing toy and play preferences of boys versus girls? But students in politically homogeneous departments will mostly be exposed to books and research studies drawn from the left half of the range, so they are likely to come down to the left of the truth on average. For example, they are likely to underestimate the elasticity of labor demand, especially if they attended prestigious universities in New England. Sometimes the left-leaning view turns out to be correct, sometimes it's the right-leaning view, but on average, students will get closer to the truth if they are exposed to debates among credentialed scholars who approach difficult problems from differing perspectives. To compound this second problem, during the same period in which the faculty were becoming more politically homogeneous, so were the students. Surveys of incoming freshmen conducted by the Higher Education Research Institute show that roughly 20% of incoming students identify as conservative, and that figure has held steady since the early 1980s. Self-described moderates made up roughly half of all incoming students in the 1980s and 1990s, but that figure has been dropping since the early 2000s, It's now in the low 40s, as the percentage of progressives, self-described liberals, rises into the high 30s. The shift has accelerated since 2012. We are not saying there's anything inherently wrong with the increasing number of left-leaning students on campus. But we are saying that viewpoint diversity is necessary for the development of critical thinking, while viewpoint homogeneity, whether on the left or the right, leaves a community vulnerable to groupthink and orthodoxy. If both the faculty and the students have been losing moderates and gaining progressives since the 1990s, and if this shift among students has accelerated since 2012, then we would expect to see some changes in the culture and social dynamics of American universities, especially after 2012. This is the third problem. It is the Durkheimian problem. It is the risk that some academic communities, particularly those in the most progressive parts of the country, may attain such high levels of political homogeneity and solidarity that they undergo a phase change, taking on properties of a collective entity that are antithetical to the normal aims of a university. A collective entity mobilized for action is more likely to enforce political orthodoxy and less likely to tolerate challenges to its key ideological beliefs. Politically homogeneous communities are more susceptible to witch hunts, particularly when they feel threatened from outside. Welcome to Evergreen. The Evergreen State College, a small public college an hour's drive south of Seattle, has long had a reputation for quirky progressivism. The college is located on a nature reserve and has its own organic farm. Instead of grades, students receive narrative reports. It has been listed as one of the 10 most liberal colleges in the country. In 2011, the college changed its mission statement to include this: Evergreen supports and benefits from local and global commitment to social justice, diversity, environmental stewardship, and service in the public interest. In May of 2017, Evergreen slipped into a state of anarchy that is difficult to explain without the help of Durkheim. Campus tensions had already been rising when, on March 15th, Brett Weinstein, a politically progressive biology professor, emailed a faculty listserv to express his concern about plans for that year's Day of Absence, which was scheduled to take place the following month. Inspired by a Douglas Turner Ward play of the same name, staff and faculty members of color, and later students too, had been spending one day off campus each year since the 1970s in order to make their absence, and thus the importance of their contributions, felt. In the wake of Donald Trump's election, however, the organizers of the 2017 event decided to make a change. Instead of the day being an opportunity for people of color to voluntarily absent themselves, this year, white students and faculty were asked to stay away from campus. Professor Weinstein thought this was wrong. He wrote, "There is a huge difference between a group or coalition deciding to voluntarily absent themselves from a shared space in order to highlight their vital and underappreciated roles, and encouraging another group to go away. In a shared space, one's right to speak or to be," he said, "must never be based on skin color." He also feared that white students and faculty who did not support the structure of the day of absence and chose to come to campus that day would be viewed negatively. Their very presence might be interpreted to mean they did not support the goals of the event. Weinstein had expressed other concerns about the direction the college was taking when, a year earlier, the college president, administrators, and select faculty committed to a campus-wide equity agenda, including a proposed policy that would require all new employees to have an equity justification. The president of Evergreen, George Bridges, had begun using the phrase "education, solidarity, inclusion" in his memos and mailings. He and his equity council had also undertaken various solidarity-building exercises, one of which included an event during which faculty were publicly pressured by name to get into an imaginary canoe in which the faculty and administration then symbolically journeyed toward equity together to the sounds of crashing waves, and a Native American drumbeat. These rituals and talk of campus-wide solidarity make sense from a Durkheimian perspective. They are ways to prepare a community for collective action. The day of absence came and went almost without incident, according to Weinstein, although not all white members of the community complied. But more than a month later, on May 23rd, after other instances of campus unrest, a multi-ethnic group of angry students marched to Weinstein's classroom door, cornered him in the hallway, and berated him. They swore at him, calling him a piece of shit and telling him to get the fuck out. They claimed that he made racist statements in his email, and they demanded that he not only apologize, but also resign. Weinstein disagreed with their assessment of his email as harmful and racist, and he refused to apologize. But he did try to engage the students in discussion, or, as he called it, dialectic, which does mean I listen to you and you listen to me. The response was not positive. We don't care what terms you want to speak on. We are not speaking on terms of white privilege. The students continued to blast the professor, and tensions mounted. Concerned for Weinstein's safety, his students contacted the police, but protesters physically prevented the police from reaching him. Campus police requested backup from other police departments. Protesters, claiming to be fearful for their lives, marched on to the administration building, where they found and confronted President Bridges outside his office. Videos of the event show protesters saying, "Fuck you, George. We don't want to hear a goddamn thing you have to say. You shut the fuck up." The president agreed to meet with protesters, along with the staff and administrators who supported them, and then assured them that, with respect to errant faculty in the sciences, such as Weinstein, quote, "They're going to say some things we don't like, and our job is to bring them all in or get them out. And what I hear us stating that we're working toward is bring them in, train them, and if they don't get it, sanction them," end quote. Yes, that is the president of a U.S. public college, which is bound by the First Amendment to protect academic freedom, proposing to fire or punish professors who do not accept the teachings of a mandatory political re-education program. Some of the protesters insisted that campus police chief Stacey Brown join the meeting unarmed. Brown, who would not disarm in uniform, changed into civilian clothes and arrived to find students shouting expletives and slurs, some directed at her. Certain protesters were assigned to her and followed her to another meeting later in the day, attended by hundreds of others. At this larger gathering, protesters attached themselves to Brown, Weinstein, and a few other non-compliant faculty and students. At all times, the protesters controlled the exits. When Weinstein's students overheard protesters say they had mace and planned to prevent Weinstein from leaving the building, they texted him to alert him. Weinstein texted his wife, Heather Hying, a fellow biology professor, "I am told I will not be allowed to leave," and then, "not sure what to do." Video of that meeting is startling. Student protesters can be heard insisting that Weinstein be fired in order to prevent him from what one white protester later described as spreading this problematic rhetoric. Students of color who spoke supportively of Weinstein, or who even asked to hear from people not in the protesters' camp, were shouted down and called race traitors. White students who were not protesting were told to stand in the back and were not allowed to speak. Students repeatedly and publicly ridiculed the college president, even berating him for smiling. One student yelled at President Bridges, who often gesticulates with his hands, "Put your hand down!" While another student mockingly imitated his hand gestures, adding, "That's my problem with you, George. You keep making these little hand movements." The president immediately put his hands behind his back as the student walked around him to laughter and applause, announcing that she was decolonizing the space. Bridges responded, "My hands are down." The next day, May 24th, protesters searched cars looking for Weinstein. They interrupted a faculty meeting and took the cake meant to celebrate retiring faculty while asking, "Didn't you educate us on how to do shit like this?" Then, According to the student newspaper, student protesters barricaded the main entrance to the administration building, and for several hours, having occupied the building and gathered together the leadership of the college, including President Bridges, they held them in an office. With a leadership team sequestered, the students prepared and later presented their demands. These included mandatory bias training for faculty and permission for protesters to not turn in their homework on time. Outside the office, students video recorded themselves making sure that the room had no escape routes and that there was enough student presence to prevent administrators from leaving. Bridges ordered the campus police not to intervene. One organizer of the protest told students there was a room for them to rest and advised protesters to make sure you're all taking care of yourselves in these moments. Immediately after giving those instructions, the same organizer entered the president's office and asked the administrators if they needed anything. Bridges is seen on video saying, "I need to pee." The organizer replies, "Hold it," as several people laugh. Protesters later escorted Bridges to the bathroom. Inside the president's office, one student protester asked captive administrators, "Don't you think it's continuing white supremacy when the leadership is only white people?" Several administrators nodded and said yes, thereby validating the student's grossly expanded definition of white supremacy. Outside the office, students chanted, "Hey, hey, ho, ho, these racist faculty have got to go." That night, in an email to the campus community, an Evergreen Media Studies professor wrote approvingly that the protesting students were doing exactly what we've taught them. The following day, May 25th, the police received information that protesters intended to target the campus police department building. Ordered to stand down, the police evacuated, setting up a post off campus and monitoring the highly charged situation using campus security cameras and a local law enforcement helicopter. Students who defended Weinstein were stalked and were targeted by protesters in thinly veiled online threats. The campus police chief informed Weinstein that, out of concern for his safety, she thought it would be best if he left campus. He held all but one of his remaining classes that quarter off campus. Aside from his wife, Heather Hying, only one professor on the entire faculty, Mike Paros, a professor of veterinary science, publicly supported Weinstein. Weinstein later learned that several other professors were supportive, but afraid to say so in public. With so little public support, with the police urging him to stay off campus, and with no national media covering the story of Evergreen's descent into anarchy and intimidation, on May 26th, Weinstein accepted an invitation to be interviewed on the Fox News TV show Tucker Carlson Tonight. Once the story went public, it attracted attention from the political right and harassment from the alt-right, which we will discuss further in the next chapter. On Thursday, June 1st, a man in New Jersey called the Thurston County Emergency Line and told the dispatcher he was on his way to Evergreen to execute as many people on campus as I can get a hold of. Law enforcement informed the school that there was no active threat, but as a precautionary measure, the campus was shut down until Saturday, June 3rd. On June 3rd and 4th, bands of students began to roam the campus armed with baseball bats and tasers, searching for white supremacists. They vandalized buildings and assaulted several students. The New Jersey man was arrested a month later. How did this mess end? Who was held accountable? On June 2nd, roughly a quarter of the college's faculty signed a letter calling for Weinstein to be investigated, blaming him for provoking white supremacist backlash, and claiming that by speaking about what was happening on Fox News TV, he endangered students. Weinstein and Hying rejected the assertion that he was to blame. As employees of Evergreen, they filed a tort claim against the college for tolerating and even endorsing egregious violations of the student conduct code, including criminal behavior, and for fostering a racially hostile work environment. In September 2017, the couple and Evergreen agreed on a settlement, and the professors resigned. Police Chief Stacy Brown later made similar charges, claiming that the hostile environment left her with no choice but to resign from the college. President Bridges, who at the beginning of the year had criticized the University of Chicago for its policy protecting free speech and academic freedom, agreed to many of the protesters' demands. He announced that he was grateful for the passion and courage the protesters displayed, and later he hired one of the leaders of the protests to join his presidential equity advisors. One of their primary tasks was to rewrite the student code of conduct. Great Untruth U. The events at Evergreen illustrate just about everything we've talked about in this book so far. The early stages illustrate Bergesen's three features of political witch hunts. The movement seemed to come out of nowhere. It was in response to a trivial provocation, a polite email sent to a faculty listserv. And the provocation was interpreted as an attack on the entire Evergreen community. As the drama unfolded, it illustrated our fourth criterion. Faculty and administrators who wanted to defend Weinstein were afraid to do so. The protesting Evergreen students and the faculty and administrators who encouraged them repeatedly displayed all three of the great untruths. For example, one professor who supported the protesters addressed some of her faculty colleagues in an angry monologue that included a line similar to the untruth of fragility, "What doesn't kill you makes you weaker." "I am too tired. This shit is literally gonna kill me." A student illustrated the untruth of emotional reasoning, always trust your feelings, at the large town hall meeting when she used her own anxiety as evidence that something was very wrong at Evergreen. "I want to cry. I can't tell you how fast my heart is beating. I am shaking in my boots." And of course, the entire episode was an illustration of the untruth of us versus them. Life is a battle between good people and evil people. The protesting students and their faculty supporters engaged in a giant game of common enemy identity politics by interpreting a politically progressive college and its politically progressive leadership and faculty as exemplars of white supremacy in action. As one student who refused to join the protesters later put it while testifying before the college trustees, "If you offer any kind of alternative viewpoint, you're the enemy." Evergreen State College is not typical. With the exception of the Milo riot at UC Berkeley, its meltdown into anarchy in the spring of 2017 is more extreme than anything else that has happened in recent decades on an American college campus, as far as we know. We have presented its story in detail because it is a warning to everyone who cares about students or universities. The Evergreen story shows what is possible when political diversity is reduced to very low levels, when the school's leadership is weak and easily intimidated, and when professors and administrators allow or even encourage the propagation of the three great untruths. In sum, 1. Humans are tribal creatures who readily form groups to compete with other groups, as we saw in Chapter 3. Sociologist Emil Durkheim's work illuminates the way those groups engage in rituals, including the collective punishment of deviance, to enhance their cohesion and solidarity. 2. Cohesive and morally homogeneous groups are prone to witch hunts, particularly when they experience a threat, whether from outside or from within. 3. Witch hunts generally have four properties. They seem to come out of nowhere. They involve charges of crimes against the collective. The offenses that lead to those charges are often trivial or fabricated. And people who know that the accused is innocent keep quiet, or, in extreme cases, they join the mob. 4. Some of the most puzzling campus events and trends since 2015 match the profile of a witch hunt. The campus protests at Yale, Claremont McKenna, and Evergreen all began as reactions to politely worded emails and all led to demands that the authors of the emails be fired. We repeat that the concerns that provide the context for a witch hunt may be valid, but in a witch hunt, the attendant fears are channeled in unjust and destructive ways. 5. The new trend in 2017 for professors to join open letters denouncing their colleagues and demanding the retraction or condemnation of their work, as happened to Rebecca Tuvel, Amy Wax, and others, also fits this pattern. In all of these cases, colleagues of the accused were afraid to publicly stand up and defend them. 6. Viewpoint diversity reduces a community's susceptibility to witch hunts. One of the most important kinds of viewpoint diversity, diversity of political thought, has declined substantially among both professors and students at American universities since the 1990s. These declines, combined with the rapidly escalating political polarization of the United States, which is our focus in the next chapter, may be part of the reason why the new culture of safetyism has spread so rapidly since its emergence around 2013. This concludes part 2 of this book. In these 2 chapters, we examine some dramatic events that occurred on American college campuses in the 2 years after we published our article in The Atlantic laying out our concerns about cognitive distortions on campus. The new campus trends make a lot more sense once you understand the 3 great untruths and can spot them in action. In part 3, we'll ask, why and why now? Where did the 3 great untruths and the culture of safetyism come from? And why did they spread so quickly in the last few years? Part 3. How did we get here? Chapter 6. The Polarization Cycle. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Isaac Newton's Third Law of Motion. We began this book with a presentation of 3 great untruths, ideas so out of tune with human flourishing that they harm anyone who embraces them. In part 2, we narrated a variety of campus events that have attracted national and sometimes global attention, and we showed how some students and professors involved in these events seem to have embraced the great untruths. Now, in part 3, we widen the lens and look at how we got here. Why did a set of interrelated ideas, which we have called a culture of safetyism, sweep through many universities between 2013 and 2017? Students who graduated from college in 2012 generally tell us that they saw little evidence of these trends. Students who began college at some elite universities in 2013 or 2014 tell us they saw the new culture arrive over the course of their 4 years. What is going on? There is no simple answer. In part 3, we present 6 interacting explanatory threads. Rising political polarization and cross-party animosity, rising levels of teen anxiety and depression, changes in parenting practices, the decline of free play, the growth of campus bureaucracy, and a rising passion for justice in response to major national events, combined with changing ideas about what justice requires. We believe that it is impossible to understand the state of higher education today without understanding all 6. Before we present these threads, however, we must make 2 points explicitly and emphatically. The first point is that there are different threads for different people. Part of the complexity of our story is that not all of the threads have influenced each person and each group on campus equally. The rising political polarization in the United States, in which universities are increasingly seen as bastions of the left, has led to an increase in hostility and harassment from some off-campus right-wing individuals and groups. Some of these events qualify as hate crimes and are targeted especially at Jews and people of color. We discuss that thread in this chapter. Rising rates of teen depression and anxiety affect both boys and girls, but have hit young women particularly hard, as you'll see in Chapter 7. The rise in overprotective or helicopter parenting and the decline of free play, chapters 8 and 9, have negatively affected kids from wealthier families, mostly white and Asian, more than kids from working class or poor families. The increase in the number of campus administrators, along with the scope of their duties, may be having an effect at all schools, Chapter 10, but new ideas and stronger passions about social justice may matter most on campuses where students are more engaged politically, Chapter 11. The second point is that this is a book about good intentions gone awry. In all of the six chapters in this part of the book, you'll hear about people primarily acting from good or noble motivations. In most cases, the motive is to help or protect children or people seen as vulnerable or victimized. But, as we all know, the road to hell can be paved with good intentions. Our goal in Part 3 is not to blame, it is to understand. Only by identifying and analyzing all six explanatory threads can we begin to talk about possible solutions, which we do in Part 4. The boiling point. In the last two chapters, we told many stories about students and faculty reacting to words in ways that seemed inappropriate, over the top, and in some cases, aggressive. Whether about a response to an email, an effort to shout a speaker down, or a petition to denounce a colleague, the stories in this book have mostly presented problems on campus that arise from a part of the political left. Sometimes the targets were on the right, such as Heather McDonald and Amy Wax, but more often the targets were themselves on the left, such as Nicholas and Erica Christakis, Rebecca Tuvel, Brett Weinstein, and the professors who taught the humanities course at Reed College. If we were to limit our analysis to events on campus, this would be most of the story. A set of new ideas about speech, violence, and safety has emerged on the far left in recent years, and the debate on campus is largely a debate within the left, pitting mostly older progressives, who generally have an expansive notion of free speech, against mostly younger progressives, who are more likely to support some limitations on speech in the name of inclusion. But if we step back and look at American universities as complex institutions nested within a larger society that has been growing steadily more divided, angry, and polarized, we begin to see the left and the right locked into a game of mutual provocation and reciprocal outrage that is an essential piece of the puzzle we are trying to solve in this book. Alison Stenger, the Middlebury professor who suffered a concussion at the hands of protesters, said exactly this in a New York Times essay titled, "Understanding the Angry Mob at Middlebury That Gave Me a Concussion." In it, she wrote, "In the days after the violence, some have spun this story as one about what's wrong with elite colleges and universities, our coddled youth, or intolerant liberalism. Those analyses are incomplete. Political life and discourse in the United States is at a boiling point, and nowhere is the reaction to that more heightened than on college campuses." She next listed several of the ways in which President Trump had insulted or offended members of marginalized groups while inspiring hateful speech among many of his followers, and added, "That is the context into which Dr. Murray walked, where he was so profoundly misunderstood." We agree with Stenger that the national political context is an essential part of any story about what has been happening on college campuses in recent years. Things are indeed at a boiling point in the United States. Two studies quantify the rising temperature. In 1994, the Pew Research Center started surveying a nationally representative sample of Americans every few years about their level of agreement with a set of 10 policy statements. The policy statements include, "Government regulation of business usually does more harm than good. Immigrants today are a burden on our country because they take our jobs, housing, and health care. And the best way to ensure peace is through military strength." Pew then calculates how far apart different groups are across all 10 issues. For instance, men and women were 9 points apart in 1994 and 7 points apart in 2017. Not much change over time. There also wasn't much change when you divide people by age, education, or race. In fact, only two divisions have grown larger over time. People who attend religious services regularly are now 11 points away from those who never attend, compared to just 5 points apart in 1994. But that 6-point increase is dwarfed by the 21-point increase in the distance between Republicans and Democrats over the same time period. They were 15 points apart in 1994, 17 points apart in 2004, and then 36 points apart in 2017. If the people on the other side are moving farther and farther away from you on a broad set of moral and political issues, it stands to reason that you would feel more and more negatively toward them. The American National Election Study provides a startling illustration of how that's happening. Every 2 years, its researchers ask Americans to rate a large set of people, groups, and institutions on a scale from 0, which means very cold or unfavorable, to 100, which means very warm or favorable. Included in that set are the Republican and Democratic parties. As you'd expect, the data show that most people feel good about their own party, and those numbers haven't moved much since the 1970s. But here's the surprise. Attitudes about the other party weren't all that negative from the 1970s until the early 1990s. They hovered in the 40s. It's only in the 1990s that the ratings begin to drop, with a plunge between 2008 and 2012, the years of the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street. By 2016, those numbers had dropped into the 20s. Why is this happening? There are many reasons, but in order to make sense of America's current predicament, you have to start by recognizing that the mid-20th century was a historical anomaly, a period of unusually low political polarization and cross-party animosity, combined with generally high levels of social trust and trust in government. From the 1940s to around 1980, American politics was about as centrist and bipartisan as it has ever been. One reason is that during and prior to this period, the country faced a series of common challenges and enemies, including the Great Depression, the Axis powers during World War II, and the Soviets during the Cold War. Given the psychology of tribalism that we described in Chapter 3, the loss of a common enemy after the collapse of the Soviet Union can be expected to lead to more intra-tribal conflict. A second major reason is that, since the 1970s, Americans have been increasingly self-segregating into politically homogeneous communities, as Bill Bishop showed in his influential 2008 book, The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. Subsequent research has shown that we live in increasingly economically and politically segregated communities, right down to the city block. The two major political parties have sorted themselves along similar lines. As the Republican Party becomes disproportionately older, white, rural, male, and Christian, the Democratic Party is increasingly young, non-white, urban, female, and non-religious. As political scientists Shanto Iyengar and Masha Krupenkin put it, the result is that today, differences in party affiliation go hand in glove with differences in worldview and individual sense of social and cultural identity. A third major reason is the media environment, which has changed in ways that foster division. Long gone is the time when everybody watched one of three national television networks. By the 1990s, there was a cable news channel for most points on the political spectrum, and by the early 2000s, there was a website or discussion group for every conceivable interest group and grievance. By the 2010s, most Americans were using social media sites like Facebook and Twitter, which make it easy to encase oneself within an echo chamber. And then there's the filter bubble, in which search engines and YouTube algorithms are designed to give you more of what you seem to be interested in, leading conservatives and progressives into disconnected moral matrices backed up by mutually contradictory informational worlds. Both the physical and the electronic isolation from people we disagree with allow the forces of confirmation bias, groupthink, and tribalism to push us still further apart. A fourth reason is the increasingly bitter hostility in Congress. The Democrats controlled the House of Representatives for about 60 years, with only brief interruptions in the mid to late 20th century. But their dominance ended in 1994, when the Republicans swept to victory under Newt Gingrich, who became Speaker of the House. Gingrich then imposed a set of reforms intended to discourage his many new members from forging the sort of personal relationships across party lines that had been normal in previous decades. For example, Gingrich changed the work schedule to ensure that all business was done midweek, and then he encouraged his members not to move their families from their home districts, and instead fly to Washington for a few days each week. Gingrich wanted a more cohesive and combative Republican team, and he got it. The more combative norms then filtered up to the Senate as well, though in weaker form. With control shifting back and forth several times since 1995, and with so much at stake with each shift, norms of civility and possibilities for bipartisanship have nearly disappeared. As political scientists Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt put it, parties have come to view each other not as legitimate rivals, but as dangerous enemies. Losing ceases to be an accepted part of the political process, and instead becomes a catastrophe. These four trends, plus many more, have combined to produce a very unfortunate change in the dynamics of American politics, which political scientists call negative partisanship. In a recent review of data on affective polarization, the degree to which members of each party feel negatively toward the other party, Iyengar and Krupenkin summarize the change like this. Prior to the era of polarization, in-group favoritism, that is, partisans' enthusiasm for their party or candidate, was the driving force behind political participation. More recently, however, it is hostility toward the out party that makes people more inclined to participate. In other words, Americans are now motivated to leave their couches to take part in political action, not by love for their party's candidate, but by hatred of the other party's candidate. Negative partisanship means that American politics is driven less by hope and more by the untruth of us versus them. They must be stopped at all costs. This is an essential part of our story. Americans now bear such animosity toward one another that it's almost as if many are holding up signs saying, "Please tell me something horrible about the other side. I'll believe anything." Americans are now easily exploitable, and a large network of profit-driven media sites, political entrepreneurs, and foreign intelligence agencies are taking advantage of this vulnerability. The vulnerability comes with an unfortunate asymmetry. The faculty and students at universities have shifted to the left since the 1990s, as we showed in the last chapter, while the outrage industry of talk radio, cable news networks, and conspiracy websites is more developed and effective on the right. The mainstream media overall leans left, but the left simply never found a format or formula that could match the influence of Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, and Sean Hannity. Right-wing media has long loved to make fun of professors and stir up anger over politically correct practices spotted on university campuses. But as campus activism increased in 2015 and offered up an unending stream of dramatic cell phone videos, including students cursing at professors and shouting down speakers, right-wing media outlets began to devote far more attention to campus events, which they portrayed gleefully, usually stripped of any explanatory context. The rising expressions of anger from the left on campus, sometimes directed against conservative speakers, led to rising expressions of anger from the right off campus, sometimes directed in threatening ways at left-leaning professors and students, which in turn triggered more anger from the left on campus, and the cycle repeats. Outrage from the off-campus right. In the last two chapters, we examined protests, shout-downs, open letters, and witch hunts originating from the left, because the left is the dominant force on most college campuses, leaving aside religious and military academies. But if we step back from campus, we see that some people and groups on the right engage in moralistic, aggressive, and intimidating actions aimed at campus, too. We told the story of Evergreen State College, but we left some of its aftermath for this chapter. As we noted, 3 days after the Evergreen implosion began at Professor Weinstein's door, when no national news outlets were covering the chaos, Weinstein agreed to appear on the Fox News show Tucker Carlson Tonight. After the show aired, the backlash began. 3 days after Weinstein's appearance, a student protester posted an essay on the website Medium reporting that a spray-painted swastika appeared on the side of a seminar building and that she and other protesters had been subject to doxing by the alt-right. As she wrote, "The faces, names, and phone numbers of student organizers were published online on subreddits dedicated to harassing leftists and people of color." In a New York Times essay published weeks later, the student described protesters being harassed with hundreds of phone calls, anonymous texts, and terrifyingly specific threats of violence that show they know where we live and work. She also recounted finding rape threats directed at her on online message boards. Sandra Kaiser, Evergreen's vice president for college relations, said the college received the most stunning wave of social media harassment you can possibly imagine. But the mob wasn't just phoning it in from far away. Although it was quickly determined that the New Jersey man's phone threat was not credible, right-wing extremist groups did visit campus. For example, the neo-Nazi group Adam Waffen Division placed posters on campus buildings reading, "Black Lives Don't Matter," and "Join Your Local Nazis." Then they posted a video depicting their members, dressed in black, with faces obscured, walking across campus at night, taping up those posters. In physics, as Newton's law tells us, every action produces an equal and opposite reaction. In a polarization spiral, however, for every action, there is a disproportionate reaction. Many critics of campus protesters in 2015 accused them of overreacting to small things, such as Dean Spellman's email at Claremont McKenna. But beginning in late 2016, we began to see more examples of off-campus overreaction from the right in response to speech by professors on the left. Lisa Durden, an adjunct professor at Essex County College in Newark, New Jersey, was hired in the spring of 2017 to teach mass communication and popular culture, as well as essay writing. Before coming to Essex, Durden was a motivational speaker, hosted her own talk show, appeared on various networks as a pop culture expert, and worked as a TV and movie producer. Then, on June 6, 2017, she appeared on Tucker Carlson's show to defend a Black Lives Matter all-black Memorial Day party, at which she was not present, in Brooklyn, New York. At one point, in response to Carlson's antagonistic questioning, she responded, "Boo-hoo-hoo, you white people are angry because you couldn't use your white privilege card to get invited." Admittedly, what she said was provocative, but the all-black event was not at the college, so Durden wasn't defending the exclusion of white students. In fact, no one has ever alleged that Durden discriminated against students. Nonetheless, Durden's television appearance was met by wrath from the right. She received hate mail and anonymous threats, which included, "I will come to your house and kill you, dumb black bitch," and, "Talk to me like you did that guy on Fox News, and I would beat you to a broken pulp and kick your throat in, you racist devil." Durden showed us many more, which we will not repeat here, but suffice it to say, they were horrifically racist, sexist, and threatening. The barrage of vitriol and the threats of violence have had a lasting effect on Durden. "I still get knots in my stomach whenever I think about it or talk about it," she told us in an email. "People say that things will get better because that's the politically correct thing to say to someone in my position. But things don't always get better. They sometimes get worse, and that's how I'm feeling." To make matters worse, the college suspended Durden and launched an investigation, claiming they had been immediately inundated with complaints. FIRE filed records requests to see those alleged complaints, which Essex County College ignored until FIRE filed a lawsuit. As it turned out, the supposed deluge of complaints before the suspension amounted to a single email. Nonetheless, on June 23rd, the college president announced that Durden had been fired. Despite all of this, Durden tells us unequivocally that she doesn't regret speaking out. Professor Durden's story is not unique. On Christmas Eve 2016, George Ciccarello Marr, a professor at Drexel University in Philadelphia, posted the provocative tweet, "All I want for Christmas is white genocide." The tweet went viral, amplified by a Russia-linked Twitter account pretending to be based in Tennessee. Taken at face value, the tweet sounds horrifying, but its meaning changes once you learn that white genocide is a term used by white nationalist groups to express their fear that mass immigration and racial intermarriage will eventually lead to the extinction of white people. As Ciccarello Marr later explained, white genocide is an idea invented by white supremacists and used to denounce everything from interracial relationships to multicultural policies. It is a figment of the racist imagination. It should be mocked